Attention, attention. Hey. Thank you, Tim. So I am Andy Furman, and I am the tasting room manager at St. George Spirits. I'm also known as a boozer and a shaker. I do find myself, well, often imbibing delicious spirits. And that's why we're here tonight, actually, to talk about delicious spirits. But let's go ahead and introduce our fine panel members, some of the Bay Area's distinguished distillers. We've got, yes, I know, it's like, have I seen you on To Catch a Predator? That actually is the real question. It's like, you look really familiar to me, sir. But I do drink quite often, so. So we've got John Dannerbeck of Anchor Distilling, Lance Winters of St. George Spirits. Well, we've got Dave Classic. I always want to say danger, sorry, but Dave Classic with Essential Spirits. And we have, and we've got Will Smith of SF Vodka.
The real Will Smith.
The real Will Smith, right? So I think tonight's discussion is going to be relatively relaxed, but ultimately I'm going to kick it off. We're going to have a nice panel discussion for about 45 minutes, and then we're going to kind of let folks line up at that time to ask questions, so we get a little bit of audience participation, which is always nice. Pressing questions, perhaps even inappropriate. We'll see how we feel. So I think my first question will be, what inspired you to get into this business, the distillation world? What is your passion? What made you get into this business, John?
That's not what the first question that we agreed to in the green room. I thought we were going to talk about streaking. Lance and I just worked that out. I think a unique position because I work at a brewery and a distillery, and so we get the best of both worlds. Anchor Brewing is, as you probably most of you know, is a product of the Gold Rush. We've been around about since the early 1850s, known as Anchor Brewing Company since 1896. Was purchased by Fritz Maytag in 1965, and he had always, for a very long time, had thought of distilling as a natural extension of brewing and had always been kind of curious about it, but wasn't really sure how to go about doing it. And then when he heard that George Washington had been a distiller at Mount Vernon, not only a distiller, but it was probably one of the most successful commercial enterprises that George Washington ever did, was distilling at Mount Vernon, and that he had made rye whiskey, that was it for Fritz. And so we started our distilling project in 1993. At the time, Lance was already doing it and was very helpful in helping us and guiding us and answering lots of questions for us about distilling. And so I guess it's just a natural extension of brewing for us. It's a lot of fun. It's a whole different world than brewing, too, in many ways.
Lance Winters?
Wow. It was for the chicks. Ellie. It's been working great for me, I got to tell you. I think I came about this, like so many other things, the exact same way Fritz Maytag did. He and I are very kindred spirits. I came from a brewing background. But really what I ended up looking for was a way to extend what that brewing experience was all about and be able to look for immortality, if you will. A beer has a very short shelf life, or relatively short shelf life. You take that beer and you distill it, you capture many of the things that you loved about that, and then you've got it in a form that's going to last forever. It can outlive me. So I thought that was a really, really beautiful thing, and wanted to take the brewing that I had some experience with at that point and learn that extension and try and figure that out. On the road to that, I met a man who's arguably this country's best craft distiller, a man by the name of Jörg Rupf, who started the movement in this country when he founded St. George Spirits. He had been distilling eau de vies, grappas, making liqueurs, and I had a very Mr. Miyagi experience with him where I said, I want to make whiskey. He said, great, go distill those cherries. Go crush those pears. I'm like, these have nothing to do with whiskey. But what he was teaching me was a love for the art and the craft of distillation. And being able to have that as the germination, the seed of everything that we do at St. George Spirits now, allows us to make what we think of as really, really amazing spirits. And it's all because of where it all started. So that's what got me into it. Mr. Dave Classic, how about you?
The devil made me do it.
I had nothing to do with it, I swear.
She was dead when you got there, right? No, I was one of those folks who, my wife and I traveled in Europe frequently, and those of you who travel in Europe know that you go around to these different places, and each area has their own regional distillery that they distill different kinds of products in, and some of them are quite excellent. And when we got back here, this was in the 90s, we didn't have any grandfathers to look up to, although there's a guy up in Mendocino County that was making arguably the world's finest cognacs, Germain Robin, Hubert Germain Robin. And because we had property up there, we went to visit his distillery. And I was just fascinated by the process, by the scale of the thing, and by the passion that he brought to this. In particular, I know he showed us some barrels and said, you know, we're putting spirits in these barrels that I will never taste because they're for the next generation of distillers. And I thought, wouldn't it be beautiful to have that kind of long view of what it is that you do and what you can contribute? And we live in one of the greatest fruit and wine-producing regions of the world, and at that time there was only a half a dozen small distilleries. St. George was around, Germain Robin was around, Anchor was around, but you know, there's only half a dozen or so in the entire western region of the United States. And we said, you know, coffee roastisseries are happening, microbreweries are happening, a micro distillery, you know, to create a tertiary industry on top of these beautiful industries that we already have, the agriculture. And so we said, well, why not? Well, when you try to put one of these together, you find out why not, but that's a different story. And so we set ourselves up, and we had to reach down by our bootstraps and haul ourselves up. Fortunately, our stillmaker, who lives in Bordeaux, a third-generation stillmaker, allowed me to come over and study with him for a few months, and I decided that this was not only something that I could do, but I loved it. I do all the cooking for my family and have for 30 years, and after having spent 20 years as a computer scientist at Hewlett-Packard and stuff, which is kind of ephemeral at best, it was really nice to come home at the end of the day and point to something that you had created and that people appreciated and understood, and it made their lives better. So we called ourselves Essential Spirits because we have a unique ability to preserve the essence of the materials that we distill, and besides which we think spirits are essential. So,
part of the daily requirement?
Absolutely.
Let that be a lesson to you.
Well, for me, yeah, well, it's never about just one thing, is it? For me, it was about the money.
Oh, really?
I had no money. I had no idea how much it took. Really. And I wanted to make sure that my children wouldn't be able to rest on my laurels. We would have to work for a living. I think I've set myself to just fine for that. Well, unlike the other guys, we're the new kids on the block. I guess we've been around since about 2009. You're 10 years, right, Dave?
Yeah.
About 25 years for York?
30.
Wow. Amazing. And John?
19
in distilling. Yeah, for us, about 4. All of our stills, unfortunately, are not from Cognac. They're from right here in Northern California, all 3 of them. All purpose-made, which I think is another term for homemade, right? Purpose-built, homemade. It's a culinary thing for me, and also an extension of brewing. We were home brewers for many years. My dad was actually involved in a commercial brewery back in the 1950s, and he's the one who really gave me an appreciation for fine spirits. He used to travel the Caribbean in his little airplane and bring back contraband. On to the next question. We shouldn't go there, I suppose.
Somebody is recording this, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You are recording this. We can use this later, right?
We're going to have our people checking the statute of limitations on this. I think you're okay.
There are still some of those fine old bottles from Haiti back in my mom's house.
Oh, that is so awesome. Yeah. The whole point of this discussion is locavore. Drink locavore. So my next question is pretty simple. It is, why local when it comes to spirits? Why is it so important? John?
Well, we were talking about this before we came out here and what that means. You know, it means different things to different people. I think it means, for us, it's a different concept than it is for the restaurant trade, where you're talking about the local restaurants are sourcing all their products from the local farmer, the local rancher, and they know where those things come from. And that's not really the important aspect of it to us from the local perspective, because we buy our rye from a large malting company, the same people we buy our barley for the beer. We buy our glass from people who make the interesting glass. It's not necessarily a local glass manufacturer, but what the local aspect of it is, the creative aspect of it. It's the history, it's the character that we're doing that's contributing to what the final product is, and local for us is the U.S. Again, when Fritz Maytag found out that George Washington had made rye whiskey at Mount Vernon, that was the local aspect of it. It's the historical aspect of it. We make rye whiskey, that's, and gin, and that's all we make in our stills, but we make three different styles of rye whiskey. One of them is a very limited special release. We release one barrel a year now, and it's called Hotowling's Whiskey. And that name came about as a result of a product that Fritz had. We'd made a rye whiskey, and we aged it and used bourbon barrels, which, if you know, used bourbon barrels, which is what Scotch whiskey is almost exclusively aged in. Every year, the bourbon manufacturers in the U.S. empty millions of barrels of whiskey, and then they sell those used whiskey barrels on to the Scots, and they age all the Scotch whiskey in them. And so Fritz experimented with our rye whiskey, and we aged it for 10 years, and after 10 years, it became very interesting, and it was time to bottle it or do something with it. But the question was, well, we already have two styles of rye whiskey. What are we going to do with the third, and how are we going to distinguish it and make it interesting? And then he had discovered the story of the Hotowling's Whiskey Warehouse down on Jackson Street. And after following the 1906 earthquake, when the fire was sweeping through San Francisco, that was the fire that did most of the destruction to the city, making its way down the hill towards Front Street and Jackson Street, and burning everything in its path, a bunch of people, which I think a bunch of people came running out of the bars, got a fire hose, ran a fire hose a mile and a half long, and protected the Hotowling's Whiskey Warehouse full of whiskey.
Yeah! Priorities.
A local writer was very amused by the story. And at the time, shortly after the earthquake, there was a lot of discussion that it was God's revenge on a city for being a very risque city. And so a guy in the East Bay wrote a little ditty that said, right? If it's true that God spanked the city for being over frisky, why did he burn his churches down and save Hotowling's whiskey? Fritz heard that story, and that was it. So our third expression of rye whiskey is Hotowling's rye whiskey. And it was first released on April 18th, 2006, in commemoration and to honor the rebirth of San Francisco on the 100th anniversary of the San Francisco earthquake. So when we're talking about local bar, the local aspect, it's much more the history, the local character, the local culture that's informing us and our products than it is the local ingredients. And honestly, I mean, in the brewing world, we would love to buy local malt. There isn't any, not in the scale that we need. We would love to buy all of our hops from California. Northern California, this area used to be a huge hop growing region. It is no longer. Nobody grows hops here anymore. So it's just, we don't have a choice.
Anyone in the audience want to start growing some barley and rye for us?
Or at least malting it?
Yeah. Barley growth is no problem because California is one of the largest barley growers, but it all has to be shipped out of state to be malted. It's either got to go to Wisconsin or to British Columbia. British Columbia.
Okay, Lance Winters.
Okay.
Why local? Why?
What does locavore mean to me? there's so much about that, and I think I'm going to build on what John was saying. A big part of it is the creativity. If we look at the Bay Area and who we are as far as sort of foodinistas, there have been a number of great movements that have started in the Bay Area when it comes to food. And the one that I think we hew to the most closely is the model that a place like Chez Panisse really takes to heart, and that is selecting the best quality raw materials that you can. And again, to speak to what John said, they're not always local. When they are, it's a great bonus. But when they're not, if we're looking for some of the best possible fruit that we can find, we go for that. And then we take that, and the locavore aspect for us is the methodology that we're using. We're shepherding those ingredients through the process as faithfully as we can to make sure that all the things that we love about them as raw materials show up in the glass as a spirit. So when you pick up a glass of Pear Eau de Vie, it is redolent of pears. When you pick up a glass of, actually one of the things that's truly locavore for us, our terroir gin. That gin is made with a number of ingredients that are wild foraged here in California. We go up into the Marin Headlands, legal areas, I promise. We bring back Douglas fir, bay laurel, coastal sage, coastal juniper berries from further south, and we bring those together and we distill those to try and get something that is not only locavore in production, but it's locavore in its aromas. It really gives you a picture of where we live. So that's a real important aspect of the whole locavore methodology to me. And then just having a connection with the people that are buying our products. I'd love to have somebody send us a tweet from Maine saying, tried one of your products, absolutely love it. But being able to meet the people in the Bay Area, have them either come to the distillery or we're out at a restaurant where they're pouring it, and getting that feedback, we don't do this. This is a tremendously difficult task to do. It doesn't make a ton of money unless you're a huge distillery. We do it for the love. We want your love. I am an attention whore, and I really want your attention. I want you to think nice things about me. And you're not going to get that from meeting me. Quite to the contrary, which is one of the reasons that I have to make really, really good spirits so that I can overcome my personal image with you and really try and curry your favor. So we want to make that as a way of reaching out. I'm going to take this farther than it needs to go, but for us, distillation is an act of creative self-expression. Everything that we make, we're expressing some sort of feeling. I can't dance like Jennifer Beals. I can't write poetry like Neruda. I can't paint, but I can distill, and I will express myself and my feelings through distillation. So for us, it's a performance art. So, yeah.
Well said.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. The aristocrats.
Oh, over to me.
Dave.
Well, indeed, because we're all passionate about what we do, there's some overlap in our perspective on these things. And I'd be lying to you if I said that we started this as a part of the locavore thought train, because that thought train didn't exist back when we started this. But for us, for myself and my family, because what we're doing is we're building a distilling family dynasty. That is the vision, you know, for Essential Spirits. And my son, who distills with me, is back at the back of the room right now, was raised at the still. And it was really about lifestyle and having a craft that we could pursue that would not only bring us pleasure and bring you pleasure. In fact, our company motto is, we improve your spirits by improving our spirits. The time I spent at Hewlett-Packard, I was mostly focused on quality and process management and things like that. So I saw an opportunity to get into an area where we could be creative with our hands, create something of value for people that would, like you said, create joy. One of our greatest pleasures in serving, and you'll see this tonight, is there are certain products that we make that people have had experiences with that aren't as great as they could be. Grappa comes to mind. You know, usually when we talk about grappa to people, they wince and start telling us the story of somebody that trapped them in this Italian cafe and made them drink grappa that they never recovered from, you know. And
it's what we serve to dinner guests who won't go home.
That's right. It's like
grappa. Well, you know what we say about grappa, it's the poor stepchild of the alcohol world, because everybody blames their hangover to grappa. But the reality of it is,
they drank before.
The only reason you drank grappa is because you'd already had too much to drink.
That's right.
until you try our grappa, you know.
There you go.
And so they approach the glass very tentatively, and then when they get a chance to taste this, their face lights up and they go, wow. And that is the moment that we live for to a certain extent as distillers. And it was also part of, as I say, lifestyle, bringing that European sense of how one incorporates spirits into your life. I mean, Americans' drinking habits are in need of some reform, I think. You know, a lot of them binge drink on the weekends and then think that a hangover on Monday is the wages of sin. Well, I guess this kind of goes back to our Puritan history or something. But, you know, Europeans kind of incorporate alcohol into their life in a bit different manner. And so you take it with your food. It's a part of your lifestyle. And it informs and improves your life if you're drinking good spirits like ours. And so the idea that we could help transform the American drinking public's habits by bringing to them old world class spirits was a part of our purpose in doing this. And also, as I say, you know, creating this distilling family dynasty thing. And in terms of, I guess the only other locavore note I bring to it is I located the distillery close to our house so that I could ride my bicycle from the distillery home. Because we started this, I wasn't sure if I was going to see policemen parked at the edge of the parking lot every day, you know, once they found out what we were doing. So I go from my home to the distillery and the grocery store, and that's a very local kind of a pattern for me. So.
The close proximity is really good. I find it conducive as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
As long as you don't fall off your bicycle.
True.
Well, as some of you know, we're SF Vodka is actually made in San Francisco, although you might not know of it as San Francisco. We're on Treasure Island, and we have a petition to have the island renamed Booze Island. We'd like to have your support on that. there are several companies out there making spirit and wine products. But for us, you know, we are making a really fine vodka. I hope you like it when you taste it later on. The critics really like it. It's very highly regarded. And it's made from California grapes, 100% California grapes from Northern California. It's locavore as you can get, at least here in San Francisco. Very few vineyards in the city. Anybody know of any, we'd be happy to buy grapes from them. So.
Yeah, I think certainly being in the Bay Area with all of the craft cocktail movement and everything else, there was such a glut, namely that there are so many different distilleries all over the world producing fine products, no doubt, but there was nothing really being done locally except for, well, the fine and the few, right? So I think with this whole movement, when it comes to drink local, locavore spirits, it's important that we're here because we do obviously create the platform, the foundation. There's a story, there's connection. And when I go to the bar, Stephen Lyles, I expect to see you behind the stick pouring St. George spirits. Remember that. No pressure. But I am up here and you're down there. No, he's like, I hate your guts now. At any rate, so I think my next question is kind of open it up. Like, what struggles do you face maintaining the quality and passion in a market seemingly flooded with so many well-made spirits? Like, why should folks choose yours? What struggles do you face, John?
it's a slam dunk, right, John?
It's so easy.
Dave's company motto reminded me of Pat Paulson, who was at best like a C actor. You remember Pat Paulson back in the 70s? He seemed to, like, run for president every year. You remember what his motto was? We've upped our standards, up yours.
Yes.
I love it.
Sorry. The barriers, you know, well, we were talking about this beforehand. I mean, it's when Fritz first produced the rye after it had aged for several years in barrel and bottled it, we couldn't find a distributor. No distributor would take us on. We begged the big distributors to take us on. We said, you don't even have to sell it. We'll sell it. Just deliver it. By law in California, it's a mandatory three-tier system. So we're only allowed to sell our spirits to licensed wholesalers who then sell it on to the retail trade. In the beer world, we can sell beer to anybody we want to right out of the brewery. We could go direct to anybody if we wanted to. We don't. We love the three-tier system. But we just didn't have any choice in the spirits business. It was just a terribly hard sell. And it was a very small production. We're still really rather tiny. And so we just went out, and Fritz went out around San Francisco and started selling bottles into the local restaurants where he would go, or bars, places he knew, some liquor stores, and then asked them to, you know, to ask their local distributor rep, take us on. And, it was pretty tough getting going here locally for many years, but then it started to get going a little bit, and then a couple other people started to, you know, a couple other craft distillers came on. New York Times Wednesday Dining and Wine started to take notice, which got the attention of some of the retailers, which got the attention of some of the distributors, and so it kind of started to snowball a little bit. Again, it's, you know, there are basically two large spirit and wine distributors in California, Southern Wine and Spirits and Young's Market. Each of them has a book that is literally this thick with all of the products that they sell. So to get a salesperson from one of those distributors to devote even 5 minutes a week to one of your products is a Herculean effort and a remarkable success if you can get it. And it's still that way, except for the fact that craft distilling is beginning to really blossom. It's probably safe to say that the industry is exploding. There are craft distillers in every state now, and people are really starting to take note of it. And it's part of the, I think it's almost like the last segment of the food and wine and beer and now spirit renaissance that's been taking place for, say, the last 40 years, which really began right here in the Bay Area, but it's now sweeping the world.
Yeah, we saw coffee roasting get better. We saw wine lists go from being Hardy Burgundy and Chablis being the only offerings that people had to people understanding what Shiraz is. We went from drinking nothing but Anheuser-Busch products and Coors products to having this amazing wealth of different beers available. We're starting to see that with distilled spirits. And to sort of take some of your question here, because I don't think that there's any problem maintaining the passion, right, Ellie? The passion is always there for making these spirits. If the passion's not there, I'll quit my job. But the hardest part is the education. We've had literally decades in this country where all spirits were coming from large factory-style places, and spirits have been treated like a commodity in this country. And they've been sold like a commodity, not based on their value, based on what sort of spiffs people could get for bringing them in. And so no one really learned to understand any qualities of these spirits. They became brand loyal, but it was really loyal to a label, not to what was in the bottle for the most part. People are finally starting to learn about spirits. It's a hard process. It's a lot like learning about chili peppers, where you have to start with something that's relatively mild and work your way up. But after a while, you're okay with that heat, and you can notice subtle variations of flavor from one thing to the next. Spirits are that way. And we're getting people to the point where, not we as St. George Spirits, but the industry, the culture in this country, sorry, I'm getting so choked up now. You guys have me on a roll.
No.
Thank you.
Can we get a tissue?
So sweet day. No, what's going on now is all of you people, you wonderful people, are really taking this to yourselves and saying, I want to know more about this. That's why you're here tonight. You want to learn more about spirits, and you want to learn all their nuances. And at that point, people can start tasting these nuances, and then they can make really informed decisions as to what they like. It's not based on some really clever ad they saw somewhere. It's not based on what their friends say they need to drink to be cool. It's based on what their taste buds are telling them and what they're smelling. And based on that wow factor that Dave's talking about, you know, somebody picks up a glass and they say, wow, I've never smelled that in a spirit before. It's amazing. It's delicious. I want that. And that's the tough job, is getting people to that point, getting them to the point where they're not saying, I need to mix this with orange juice, right? I need to throw this in a blender with a bunch of ice cream, right? No, you don't. This is not for a mudslide. This is for you to sit and sip. Try it. Enjoy it. If you don't like it, go find something else for a while and then come back to me. So it's that's the hard thing for us, is I think really being able to educate people.
Well, it's difficult, but it's a labor of love, because, like I say, what we were trying to do is bring kind of an old world awareness to, you know, this kind of product area. And And as Lance alluded to, there's this awakening that was happening among people. People were going, we're not going to take it anymore. We don't want big mass brands. We don't want the same experience. Drive across America today, every region you go through, you go to a shopping area, they've all got the same stupid stores and restaurants. It's, you know, this mass experience that people are desperate to get away from. And, you know, they started to some extent with the food consciousness where people were realizing that they could buy local vegetables and things. And a homegrown tomato is like a joyous experience compared to those things they sell at the store. And so giving, providing a spirit to the consuming public, y'all, gives them the opportunity to become aware. And, you know, prior to that time, that opportunity was sadly missing. And so now we are at the cutting edge, having stepped into these waters a few years back and matured to the point where we're able to create among us as an industry a whole plethora of opportunities to experience different kinds and qualities of spirits that it's an education, and there's nothing better than being SMRT, you know.
Wait, what? Sorry.
SMRT.
I am so smart. SMRT.
I like it.
It's smart and efficient.
Yeah.
Will?
Well, I think, Dave, the thing you're talking about when you is compression of choice. It happens from big box stores, and we've gotten used to it. If you go to these towns all across America, you see the same restaurants, the same McDonald's that you see in every place. And Walmart does that to us, too, I think. You know, only the things that Safeway wants to buy are the things that you want are going to get offered. And if we can't provide 3 50-foot trailer trucks full of product to them on a almost weekly basis, then they don't have an opportunity to work with us. Their chain is too big.
In fact, an interesting story. One of our clients is building a brand down around San Diego of a grape-based vodka that we make for them. And he, Albertson's store agreed to take his product in and put it on the shelf. So he's sitting in there negotiating with them about where was this product going to be and what was the pricing going to be and so on and so forth. And during this meeting with the Albertson's representative, there's another guy in the room, hadn't said much or whatever, and our client asked the Albertson's guy, so who's that? And so, oh, that's the big-name brand distributor. They actually own the shelves in Albertson's. They lease the space in the store, and they own those shelves, and there is nothing that gets on that shelf without that big-name distributor's approval. So they, you know, and that's how they keep the smaller, more, you know, artisan craft brands from getting to the consuming public to a certain extent. They have a lock on the channel, you know, to get to market. And when I heard that, I said, well, okay. So there's among the reforms that we need to, you know, create opportunities. Somebody mentioned earlier, I think it was John, said that they can only sell their spirits to wholesale distributors. Well, we happen to have a brandy maker's license as well as a distilled spirit plant license. And it turns out with the brandy making, that's to say spirits that are produced from fruits, we can sell directly to the public, we can sell to retailers, we can sell to wholesalers. But we can't do that with the gin, the vodka, and the other spirits that we make, our rums. And, you know, I've asked this question of several regulators. I go, what sense does this make? Brandy is ethanol, and rum and gin is ethanol. If you can sell this ethanol to people directly, why can't we sell that ethanol? I mean, it makes no sense unless you understand the political history of California when they passed repealed prohibition. They wanted to put the three-tiered scheme into place, and everybody wanted to be tough on alcohol. Well, a lot of winemakers up in Napa had brandy stills in their back room, so they went to the legislature and lobbied them for special privileges for brandy makers. So the legislature, still wanting to appear tough on alcohol, was able to put the weight of the three-tiered scheme on the backs of the grain-based producers, of which California had exactly none. And so they were able to be tough on alcohol, but not annoy an important constituency, you know, up in Napa Valley there. And so you've got this patchwork quilt of regulations that keeps the market from actually operating effectively and efficiently and enabling us as producers to get out there and present you with the kind of spirits and goods you want and in fact, crave. Funny how that happens, huh? There's a lot of craving that goes on in this business.
I think it's definitely, sorry, I'll put it right in front of my mouth here. It's clear that there's a lot of struggles when you're a smaller company, no doubt. You are local, all family-owned right here, so it's one of those things that it's important that you be able to get that product out there. So noting that there's some issues there, you can revisit those.
Yeah, but seriously, I think it's important to say that there's a lot more joy to being small than there are problems. I don't have to send memos up any chain to try and get anything that I want to do approved, and most of the people that work at the distillery, except for you, Andy, are in that same boat, and we're small enough to be maneuverable. We can do whatever we like. If there's a product that we want to put out, there's a minimum number of hurdles, and it's exciting that we can do that, and we can put out a product, and we don't need to sell a million cases for it to work, whereas a lot of these big producers, with the infrastructure that they have, that's what they have to do. So we're not confined by that, and that lack of confinement really gives room for our creativity to just grow. Some of the things that we've made, I got a lot of pushback just from some of the salespeople that we work with until they tasted it. And they're like, wow, nobody else would have done this, and except maybe the people up here on this stage would have done it. But none of the big companies would do the things that we're doing. They would never think to do those things because they're too crazy. We're small enough to be crazy, and it's fun to be crazy like that.
Well, and sorry to interrupt, but for a large spirit company, they're mostly large. The large spirit companies that we're referring to are big, you know, international conglomerates. For them to think of something, it has to sell, you know, a minimum of 500,000 cases the first year. We'll sell 15,000 cases total across our entire spectrum this year.
We'd like to sell 500
Damn, Skippy,
cases.
Right. Oh, pardon me. You can bleep that part out.
You just have to up your standards.
So you need a bigger boat? Is it that kind of thing? It's like you need a bigger warehouse, man.
Speaking of really great company mottos, the up yours.
For the record,
I think I used to work for this company. I think their motto was, "We're not happy until you're not happy." I think we were talking about challenges earlier, and I think for us, we did the math on this earlier today. Big conglomerates, when they try to communicate with you, they buy media. For one company that I'm thinking of, I know that their advertising budget with just one small publication that's local here to the Bay Area, I believe, is $15,000 a year. If we compare that to how many cases of product they sell a year, which I think in their case is about 9 million, for us, at our scale, we'd have an advertising budget of 83 cents.
Postage stamps?
Yep, two postage stamps. Yeah. Yeah. So that's
one. 1.5 cent postage stamps? I did that math in my head,
oh,
by the way.
Oh, good for you.
Do you know that alcohol beverage laws in the United States are governed by the states? Each state has their own laws. It's not the federal government. There are certain federal standards of labeling. The formulation. So, you know, by law, vodka can have no distinguishing taste or character unless it's flavored. Gin has to have juniper
and
other botanicals.
And other botanicals,
yeah.
Exactly.
Those are the federal standards, but the delivery of and the sale of them are all governed by the states.
And how many states are there?
Well, there's
83.
There's it's starting to drink. There's almost grande. Totally an and then there's way out of control, which is where I like to live.
Well, the point was that each of the counties in Hawaii is a separate jurisdiction.
Yeah.
D.C.
Yeah,
is another one. Yeah. I think it's something. It's pushing 60 different quote states. that we have to be regulated by.
Yeah, and it does make it difficult because it's almost like exporting to at least 50 little countries. We were talking earlier about the fact that in Tennessee, every single county has to have a separate distributor. So it's crazy, it's convoluted, but the easy way around that is to not sell to Tennessee until you're big enough to actually be able to hop that hurdle. So,
or engage with somebody who does it for you.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you why I got in this business. I like to drink a lot.
Does that work for you?
It does really work for me, but what I found most exciting about certainly the craft distillation movement and wanting to drink local is the fact that you are willing to take risks, right? It's not guaranteed success. It's literally coming up with something that excites you, stimulates you. So new projects moving forward, I think that people who drink locally, they absolutely understand that you're producing a beautiful spirit, which they can, you know, contend with, drink quite often, maybe on the daily, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, that kind of thing. But I think people are also excited because we are in the Bay Area, the land of innovation, innovative drinking, cocktail making, and shaking. Any future projects that people can get excited about?
Yeah, I'm not going to announce them tonight, but yeah, we're definitely working on some stuff. I was going to ask what you guys think. You know, it's my opinion that all the, you know, an alcohol beverage, starting with beer and now in craft distilling, all of the really interesting innovation, the creativity, has come out of California, and it's really come out of the Bay Area and Northern California. Do you think that's safe to say?
Oh, I think it's very safe to say.
I mean, the first distilleries are just in, you know, Brooklyn is just getting their first distilleries. I think there are some up and running now.
We'll get two of them.
Yeah.
Brooklyn and Brookline.
Oh, I don't know. I think that there's some really nice, interesting things going on in a lot of these places. Like Colorado is just busting out with, you know, small-scale distilleries.
I forgot the Napa Valley of Colorado.
Yeah, and so it's kind of, but it's...
That's their marketing campaign.
So they're kind of what they call, in chaos, yeah, theory, strange attractors that are forming in this milieu. And, you know, so you can kind of see the pot starting to bubble, if you will, if you have the kind of meta perspective on these things. And again, I think it's driven largely by people's desire to, and they're becoming aware, they're becoming awakened. It's like raising children, you know, you see them starting out small, and then they get to the point that they can walk and talk, and then you get to have some real interesting conversations with them. And that's kind of, I think, the point to where we're getting with the consuming public around these kinds of products is people are beginning to be aware. I mean, with spirits, it's really strange. People know about how to make wine. People know about how to make beer because these things you're allowed to make at home. And so people, a lot of people, probably many of you, have experimented.
You're not
with.
Allowed to distill at home?
No. No. Not a single drop. Not legally speaking.
Okay. For the record, that was Lance that said that.
That's right.
And for the record, we're way past the statute of limitations.
Right.
So chill.
So they don't, you know, so spirit production of spirits, for even people who are selling these products and stuff, many of them are relatively incognoscati. They really don't understand how spirits are produced and how they come into being. It's like alchemy of some sort. Which makes it really cool to be in that whole area because, well, we have it.
Is your vodka 38 times distilled?
No, thank God. We only need to distill it once to make it good on our still.
See, that's it.
But the production of spirits, like we have this Rumpelstiltskin story, you know, it's like you take grappa, for example. When you're making grappas, you take the grape skins from the press and you put them in the still, and you can cook the rest of the alcohol that they couldn't squeeze out into the wine. And so it's kind of like making gold out of straw, you know. And so you can take these products and transform them into this entirely new magic experience that people can enjoy.
And you're willing to share with them.
Yeah.
It's full disclosure. Being local and obviously a legitimate business, not distilling at home in Fremont. People are not like, sorry. You actually can have them come into your home and you can answer questions.
Yeah.
And it's like, I want to answer your questions. You want to ask me about the process, what we're using as base material? I absolutely want to tell you about it.
Yeah.
It's that relationship. You're engaging them. They're engaging you. And it is still magical, though, especially when they start to get looped out.
Every day, every drop. I mean, when we are distilling and stuff, you know, each pass that comes through, we're tasting each spit that comes through the still. I mean, you just put your finger in there and put it on your tongue. It's not like you stand there and drink all day.
Quality assurance.
Some people think, you know, that's
his finger's been through all the stuff you're going to drink.
That's right. But it's 190 proof, so, you
can just say, and you're welcome to the audience. Yeah. And you're welcome.
Andy, I was actually more upset about you calling me out on Fremont than on illegally distilling at home. We're going to have words about that, but I want to answer your question about new stuff, because I have ADD and new stuff is always bright and shiny and exciting for me. So, and this is actually very topical because of the locavore thing. We've been lucky enough through the community that we have here in the Bay Area to be exposed to some people who really care about the ingredients that they use in their restaurants. One of them is a restaurant in the East Bay called Oliveto. Bob Klein, the owner of that restaurant, smuggled in from Italy an heirloom varietal of corn, red flint corn called Floriani. He's having it grown organically now up in Woodland. And he's got some extra, and he just happens to be storing it in Alameda. I thought, okay, that's a good step forward. Met a guy who's got a farm up in Shasta. He's growing rye. There are two pieces of a puzzle coming together here. Reached out for some friends who are brewers who have an estate-grown beer. They're growing California barley, shipping it out of state, having it malted, and then bringing it back in. You put those three things together in the right ratio. You ferment them, distill them. What do you have?
Well,
anyone?
What barrel?
Thank you. Again, with the laws,
a local TTP.
So once they are distilled and then they spend time in a new charred American oak barrel, not less than 2 years for a straight bourbon at 125 proof or above.
Or less.
Or above for the straight bourbon, below for bourbon that you're going to age for longer than that. But new charred American oak is key there. You got a bourbon. So we're working on an all-California, very locavore, organic bourbon. And since we've got the rye available, we're going to do a straight rye as well. So those are a couple things that we're working on that we're very, very excited about. So,
well, one of the goofy things that happened to us in this same vein of new products, people came over and they were excited about what we were doing. And they had their ideas about what they wanted to do. So we turned the machines over to them, and you'll get a chance later on to taste some of the things that some of our partners are doing in our distillery with their own brands. All they had to do was write the check and help a little bit.
I like it. So we're going to be taking questions from the audience soon. So if you wanted to start lining up where the mics are, oh, mic, singular sensation right over there. So you want to start lining up now. Definitely take note that if we are, well, you're going to have that whole 15 minutes to yourself, love.
Is that going to be that long? It was just a quick question about
I was going to say that you had to line up now take your questions momentarily. Isn't that the correct?
Well, Sorry. I'm hoping you'll get to it.
I know. I'm going to make you wait, but you'll want it that much more. Isn't that right? Isn't that how it works?
Yeah.
All right. So as a reminder to the audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club In Forum, Connect Your Intellect, and tonight we're hosting Distilled in San Francisco, How to Drink Like a Locavore, with John Dannerbeck of Anchor Distilling, Lance Winters of St. George Spirits, Dave Classic of Essential Spirits, and William Smith of SF Vodka. All right, so are we at the time where it is? Oh, when we're ready. So I totally lied to you. I'm ready for you. Madam, your question, please.
Actually, I'm assuming you all have tasting rooms, and I'd like you to just maybe, if you do, share something about them.
I'll answer that question. Now, John, do you guys have a tasting room?
No, we're not allowed to.
What's up with that?
Well, we haven't. You have to jump through hurdles to do it. Again, it comes back to the state regulations on alcohol. If you're a brewery, you can have a tasting room. You can sample. If you're a winery, you can have a tasting room you can sample. If you're a distillery, you can't really have a tasting room per se. You can sample.
In specific counties?
Yeah, well, and we're a distillery in a brewery, which complicates it even that much more. So we don't have a public.
No.
That's the short answer.
Well, I'm going to skip Lance because we already know the answer to that one. But Dave, do you guys have a tasting room down there?
Well, we have an area that's marked on the plans as a laboratory that if you were to walk up there and sit yourself down on a stool, would certainly look as though it were a tasting room. And, you know, if we have to set a glass in front of you because we didn't have any place else to set it, well, then, you know. But this, again, is one of those strange things. As a brandy maker and a distilled spirit plant, John allowed, a distilled spirit plant is allowed to sample to the public. But as a brandy maker, we're not supposed to sample any of our brandies in the thing. And
But you can sell them.
You can sell them.
But you can't taste sample.
You know, and you just go...
Sight unseen, baby. Just buy it.
So we struggle daily to make sense out of this, you know, patchwork quilt of regulations in an effort to succeed and, you know, serve the public. But yes, it's possible if you were to call us ahead of time and... You know, we would open our door and
I was going to say house calls.
Yes, absolutely. We'll chase you down the street.
And you guys don't.
And at Treasure Island Distillery, we do not have a tasting room at present. Maybe someday. Again, patchwork of laws and things like that.
Well, are you guys actually subject to the laws of the state of California? Is that not federal land?
We are on federal land. Interestingly enough, though, we would have to export our product into California if we did not request jurisdiction. So we had to do that back in 2007. We got the state to agree to issue us an ABC license. Otherwise, we could shine them on. Yeah. We could give them the middle finger. But it wouldn't help us.
Okay.
You'd be able to have a casino out there, too, and stuff. No,
again, you know, there's so many wonderful things you can drive around without a seatbelt on.
Pretend you're in New Hampshire.
Yeah. But you get busted.
I know what I'm doing after this.
Right. It's the biggest thing. As soon as I drive through the gate, off it goes. Yeah. I want to take my risks. Yeah. You know?
Lance, do you want to answer the question whether or not St. George Spirits has a tasting room?
God, yeah.
It's world class.
They've got the best tasting room.
In the planet.
Stop it.
In the universe.
It. You guys are going to make me blush. I love you all, too. One of the greatest things about our tasting room... other than Andy, of course, is the fact that it's got one of the most stellar views of both the San Francisco skyline and of a distillery. You look out one side, there's this great copper gleaming skyline, and then out the other side is San Francisco across about 2 miles of former naval runway. We're out on the old Naval Air Station in Alameda, and it's just a killer spot.
If you get a really good telescope, you can even see our distillery from his distillery.
And we are watching you all the time.
But it's a great spot. We do have a tasting room, and we love having a tasting room so that we can watch people taste our stuff.
Yeah, we're open to the public Wednesday through Saturday, noon to 7, Sundays noon to 5. We do tours, tastings, education. It's one of those things where we have the unique opportunity again to engage people. We get to drink every day with people like you.
I warned the Commonwealth Club about having you moderate this.
Plug.
Drinking is a job description.
For us,
is,
you just
actually.
Have to tap on the door and say, swordfish.
I like that kind of speakeasy. So before you ask your question, I'm going to say that you have to choose one of our lovely bachelors.
And,
oh, I'm sorry, panelists. Oh,
oh here
we go. Choose one of them to ask the question.
Okay, so because of my experience, this question is going to be for Lance. I, some years ago, came to your lovely distillery and took a tour with Andy.
I'm sorry.
I was not on my best behavior. I wasn't married at the time. I didn't know that you were married at the time. I apologize deeply.
I came incredibly hungover and still had an amazing time, which was an unusual thing for me to be hungover coming in. But it was a great experience for me and made me, you know, it opened my eyes to quality. And put me in a position where when I go and I want a cocktail or want something to drink in a restaurant or anywhere now, I look for those local products because I know that there's quality in them. And I tell my friends, and my friends live in different places like New York and, you know, and other places like that. How are you guys handling that kind of demand that's been increasing throughout this time?
First of all, thank you for your compliments. Those are really, really, seriously, those are what we live for.
Do you work
really...
there also?
No,
she was certainly my second
too.
Choice for moderator.
It's, 7 people now.
No, it's a great question because it's really difficult to do. It's difficult to make sure that in a place like New York, you're all the way across a continent. making sure that you've got the right representation. John and I were talking about this earlier, finding somebody who not only understands how these products are made, but has a passion for what you do. Very, very difficult to identify, but that's the first step, finding somebody who can be your local rep in an area, and then finding a distributor who also cares about the way something is made. Being able to put those two things together, and then also we've got a fantastic director of communication at the distillery handling outreach with Twitter and with Facebook. Those things actually, in this day and age, really count as high-level support for the distributors that are out there. Those distributors need to see that level of support, and it's one of the things that I think for the future moving forward as we see this explosion of craft distilleries across the country, what's going to make or break them is going to be how well they're going to be able to interface with the distributors that they've got. So for us, it's putting the right people on the ground in those markets and making sure that the distributors feel supported. And then we have to pick and choose which markets we're going to be in. The ones that we're not in, we try and find people who can mail order into the markets that we're not in. There are a number of different people. I mean, in the city, Cask and K&L both ship outside of the state. Down in Southern California, High Times ships all over the place. Liquor.com, there are a number of different things that we use as sort of our proxy distributors, if you will, in some of those other states.
How do you keep up with the production for the demand, I guess, is more my...
We have an amazing team of talented Keebler elves at the distillery that we've seated the audience with a bunch of the people that work at the distillery, and they work tirelessly, and we've sized the distillery such that it's big enough to produce a lot more than we need to right now.
Gotcha. So, thank you.
You're
Room
very welcome.
Growth.
Thank you.
Hey. I'll see you at the distillery Saturday, 1 p.m. for Stuart. Next question. Do you know who you'd like to focus?
I think so, but I'll present it to the entire panel.
I love you.
Thank you. The issue about the malted barley having to come from other states, aside from the liquor laws and everything, that part sounds really stupid. What's the problem? Why can't we get...
It's not a legislative issue. What it is that the economics of operating a malting house, they're very expensive. How many people here are living in California? Show of hands. Nice. Okay, so you all know that this is not a cheap place to live. Real estate here is difficult to come by, and to that end, we've seen orchards of pears be ripped out to make room for either grapes that pay more per acre, or for condos that pay more per acre.
Or computer manufacturers.
Right, exactly. So the economics that are involved here, it's very expensive to build one of these places. The equipment that's used, there are only a handful of manufacturers of malting equipment. It's very, very equipment intensive or labor intensive. So and there's a really good shot at failure with a lot of that too. So it takes a lot of money to get started in that. The people that are doing it, who are very good at doing it, are established in the places that they're in. John's spent a lot more time in the brewing world. I shouldn't have just jumped all over the question, but
no, that's, you hit it on the head.
Okay. Awesome.
Might be some property outside of Fresno, perhaps.
Oh, it's remarkable how expensive even out there is.
Yeah.
So,
for okay,
thank you for your question.
I'll direct my question to the gentleman from San Francisco Vodka. As I understand the federal regulations, vodka is distilled and then filtered through charcoal until no discernible taste or aroma remains. Why do vodkas taste different from one another?
Oh, that's a really good question. Because they do. I think the structure of what, the brandy that you've made the stuff from, fundamentally, it's a redistilled brandy. That fruit has a roundness to it that charcoal isn't going to filter away. At least it doesn't when we do it.
And I think the real question that needs to be asked is, this is a federal regulation, and we're talking about a federal interpretation of taste, which is going to be very subjective at best.
Yeah.
So you can put you can put a group of different grappas in front of them, and anyone in this room would be able to know the differences between them. If they're done well, you'll even be able to pick up the varietal that they're made from. But the federal government says you cannot put a varietal name as a true description of a grappa because no one can pick up those differences. So their definition of flavorless and odorless is very different from the real definition of flavorless and odorless.
I actually have
a characteristic, I think, in the regs.
Yeah.
I have a little different answer for you, and it goes to the fact that when you distill vodka, it's distilled to 190 proof, which is 95% alcohol. There's 5% left of material in that aqueous solution that isn't ethanol, and that contributes certain what they call organoleptic kind of properties. And so if you're distilling from different materials, because a vodka can be made from wheat, grapes, grain, potatoes, or any combination thereof.
Ethylene gas.
As long as it's distilled to 190 proof, it meets the definition of a neutral spirit. But you still got that 5% of materials in that aqueous solution that can contribute to that difference, I think, that you detect, along with, you know, the answers that my peers gave me here.
And charcoal's not required. It's charcoal or additional distillation. So there are two different ways to make it.
So unfortunately, we don't have any more time for the audience questions, and you're the last one. But hey, can I promise to meet you at the table later?
Sneak one more in.
I just wanted to know, to San Francisco, have any of you considered making absinthe?
Okay. That's it. Absolutely, yeah. You have to come to the table.
You work for him, don't you?
No, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay.
All right.
Another show.
Okay, so you absolutely should know that absinthe has been legalized in the United States in 2007. The first American distillery to produce an absinthe is actually St. George Spirits. But
I'm not aware of any local distillery that's making it. And History Channel did a wonderful special where they showed how.
You come to my table. I want to see you later. We're going to talk about it. All right, so here at Inforum, we always like to end all of our events by asking the speakers the following question. Are you ready? Deep breath in. Okay. John, Lance, Dave, and Will, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world?
I know.
Oh. Start.
John. Right. Dave, start.
Buy and drink artisan craft spirits daily.
John?
I'm stalling for time, man.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there's some kernel of nugget of truth to that. I think drink moderately more, maybe. Right? You know? Really?
Did you speech writer? You're refining this message really.
You know,
nicely.
You think about it, though, there's a large segment of the world's population that doesn't drink. There's
that was some rolling of the eyes there for the radio.
None of them live here, of course.
And, you know, and I respect them for that and why they don't do that. But then in the United States, you know, we have a tiny little bitty group that has a very vocal footprint in the United States that used to be known as the Marin Institute. They've renamed themselves as Alcohol Justice. Where's the injustice? I mean, come on. You know, it's just, it's neo-prohibitionism, and I can get it that there is alcohol abuse to some degree, and maybe some of the larger multinational conglomerates maybe abuse it a little bit. But here, us, 15,000 cases a year, I don't see the abuse. And, you know, let's be honest, for what we have to sell our product for, it's not like some homeless person's going to be drinking our stuff ever. You know? And even if he did, somebody was able to scrounge the money, they're not going to find it. So, I don't know. I think drink moderately more would be my answer to that.
I like it. Will?
What's the line that Kevin Costner says? Long, deep, wet kisses that last 3 days? That'll change the world.
Oh, I thought maybe you were asking me.
Well, I'm going to your table after this.
Thanks. We have something that has a special ingredient.
Lance Winters.
You said my 60-second idea? I haven't had 61 yet. It was better in my head than it did. I'm going to take that one seriously and just say respect people's differences. I think that's the key right now to making the world a better place. And I'm just going to end it with that.
I like it. All right, so let's give a big round of applause to John Dannerbeck.
I'll do that.
Lance Winters.
Is there a meter there? The applause meter.
The applause meter.
Dave Classic.
Hey.
And Will Smith.
The real Will Smith.
I think it was a pleasure for all the gentlemen up here and, of course, myself to share our thoughts, our ideas for the Imperium, the Commonwealth Club. And this is adjourned. Hold up. Wait for it.
All right.